We are going to go on to case number 3, which is 013790, Frederick G. Reich versus the Latish Company. Mr. Gilman, thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is John Ullman, and I'm the attorney representing the plaintiffs, Frederick and Joanne Reich, who are appealing the decision which granted summary judgment to the defendants, which is the Latish Company and the Latish Company Pension Plan, and which also denied their motion for summary judgment. The Reichs are requesting as relief either that they be granted summary judgment or that the case be remanded to the district court for determination of the appropriate remedy. This case is a case under ERISA, and it poses the following issue: whether someone who is fully vested in a pension plan can be denied a disability retirement benefit on the grounds that he's not a participant in the plan.
I wonder, Mr. Ullman, if you could, the only real big question I have for you concerns your reading of Section 3.2 of the plan, which I know you discussed in your briefs, but if you could just summarize how you think one's status as a participant is either affected or not affected by a break in service, I would appreciate it.
Yes, well, as you, under any of the benefits under the plan, you have to be a participant.
So in other words, particularly the deferred vested benefit, right?
Yes, which is the benefit which the Latish Company concedes that he's entitled to. I mean, that's the first eligibility requirement, is the participant. I think if you read Section 3.3 literally, I think the more consistent definition is the one that we provided, which is that a break in service has the effect that if you're not vested in the plan, has the effect that you're not a participant then. But if you are vested in the plan, then you are a participant and remain a participant. I mean, that's the whole concept of vesting. The 3.3 makes the distinction, or at least the...
3.2, you mean.
3.2, they've argued that there's a distinction there between a participant and a member, but if you look at the definition of member, those terms are not mutually exclusive. I mean, the term member includes a participant, so...
Member is defined as includes the term participant and inactive participant, and then it says it's further defined in Section 3.2, which it is not.
Right. So it's circular in that sense. But I think that the most sensible reading of that section is that if you're not vested in the plan, and there's a termination, there's a break in service, then you are no longer a participant. But if you are vested in the plan, then you are a participant. I mean, that certainly would be also a definition that would be consistent with the definition of participant in ERISA. I mean, that's the whole concept of vesting, is that you don't lose that benefit because you lose your employee status. And if you read the rest of the plan, I think it's also consistent in the sense that the disability pension is only available if you have the 15 years of service, whereas the other benefits would be available with the 5 or 10 years of service. So that, again, that seems to be an additional benefit that you get if you vest after 15 years of service.
Now, is the amount of one's either disability pension or deferred, or retirement pension, I'll just call it generally, affected by how many months or years of service you have?
Yes.
So the break in service would also mean something in that you wouldn't be accruing more benefits.
That's correct. And in fact, the way the disability pension works, it also seems to contemplate the situation, for instance, where there is this delay in the Social Security Disability Award. I mean, the disability pension benefit states that you can't even apply for the benefit until you've gotten the award from Social Security. But then when it comes to paying the benefit, it states that there's no accrued benefit, so that if there's a delay in the award, the benefit doesn't commence until you get that decision. So even if there is several years of delay between the break in service and the actual decision from Social Security, there is no delayed benefit or accrued benefit that's paid to the employee. So it seems to contemplate precisely this situation where there is a delay.
And is there any dispute as to the amount of benefits owed if we determine that you were entitled to judgment?
I don't think there is. You know, that issue really wasn't posed in the district court because that decision wasn't reached, but at least in the interrogatory answers, that question was answered. And I don't think there was any disagreement in the parties in terms of the rather mechanical calculation that would be involved.
So his benefits would begin on April 2, 1998, the
Correct.
Date of the Social Security Administration's favorable decision.
Correct. I think that.
And you're not claiming anything before that.
I don't see how you can read the plan that way. I mean, I think it's very clear that, that there is no accrued benefit then. And I think that you know, the question kind of before the court really is a question of that goes back to the very root of ERISA itself, and that is one of the few requirements that we impose upon a disability retirement program is that it be in writing, and that also it state in its SPT, it's a summary plan description, of the at least the criteria under which the benefits can be denied. And you know, unless we actually can find language in the plan itself, that provision, that one of the few provisions we place on them is meaningless. And that's kind of our argument here, is that you have to look at this plan and read it intelligently to find out what is a participant. And the only common sense reading of this plan is that you don't cease to be a participant once you're cease to be an employee. I think perhaps the other interesting question is what to do if you find that the reading is arbitrary and capricious. We've set forth kind of the three different approaches that panels have taken in this type of situation.
Could I just interrupt? You at this stage of the game are not contesting that the arbitrary and capricious standard of review is the one that applies here?
We did not. I mean, I think there is.
I understood that you had some discussion at the district court level, but at this point, we're.
Right. I mean, in theory, there is this other, you know, standard of review, which is called arbitrary and capricious, but which is something more than that in cases where there is a conflict of interest, but that seems to be an analytical dead end. I mean, in that we don't know really when we apply that, and we really don't even know. I don't think there is a clear case where that standard has ever been applied. And we also don't even know, you know, under what conditions it would be applied. I mean, I don't know how you prove a conflict of interest. At least the Perelman seems to suggest that there would be no circumstances, much less how you would discover a conflict of interest. I mean, if discovery is limited to the record before the, you know, administrator, I don't know how you go about even finding one. So for that reason, I think it makes
okay.
sense to concede it's an arbitrary, capricious standard. I mean, So I think the other question, as I said, is what do you do? And I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, so I could address that at a later point. So.
Mr. Stevens.
May it please the court. My name is Charles Stevens, and I represent Laddish and the Laddish plan. There is no issue of law in this case and no issue of fact. The issue comes down to whether or not the plan terms, as interpreted by Laddish, were interpreted arbitrarily and capriciously.
Now, under your interpretation of the plan, as a practical matter, only a person on extended medical leave could ever be eligible for disability benefits. Is that right?
Not necessarily. My understanding from the information we obtained from Laddish and placed in the record summary judgment is that there are numerous pathways to obtain disability benefits under this plan.
Well, on what basis did Laddish decide it was time to terminate Mr. Reich? Rather than keep him on extended medical leave?
Mr. Reich believed that he required continuous oxygen at the time his doctor released him to return to work. Mr. Reich's own doctor released him to return to work. and Mr. Reich, for a period of over 2 years, had been unable to convince the Social Security Administration that he was disabled.
Well, then, is it within the company's discretion to decide whether to grant extended medical leave as opposed to termination?
Yes, it is. You should also understand that the union is always looking over the employer's shoulder.
But if that's correct, then it would seem the disability benefit is illusory because a company can just fire employees who are disabled and then none will ever be eligible for the benefit because they can't then meet the definition of participant.
First of all, I agree that while you can paint a picture that could permit unfairness to occur, the existence of the union here and Mr. Reich's status as a union employee long term caused that, first of all, not to be the case here.
But
second,
we're talking about language in a plan. We're not talking about sort of on-the-ground pragmatic constraints on how discretion is exercised. And my concern has been the same as Judge Rovner's, which is that if you just decide to terminate somebody and therefore make them a former employee, then they'll never get Social Security benefits. They'll never get the disability benefits under the plan because they're now terminated. So you can make sure that no one, that it's a set of zero, if that's what you want to do. Just make sure you terminate them before they have a chance to apply for their Social Security.
Terminate them 30 days before their hearing.
But unfortunately, for Mr. Reich, that simply did not happen here.
But that's not what we're talking about. I'm talking about how your plan is worded. And while you're at it, the other thing that concerns me about your position is how one gets to the point that the word participant, which is a defined term in the plan, means one thing in section 4.3, dealing with disability retirement benefits, and something quite different in section 4.4, deferred vested retirement benefits, when you concede that Mr. Reich is a participant for 4.4 purposes.
We concede that Mr. Reich was a participant until he incurred a break in service.
No, but if it's a break in service, he's not a participant for 4.4 either. That doesn't say a former participant. It says a participant who attains his deferred vested retirement date.
I believe
that...
It
doesn't say anything about former.
The interpretation of the district court and Latish's interpretation, which is at issue here, was that once you earn a benefit as a participant, then you are entitled.
And that's the same thing in 4.3. He had been in the company for 15 years, far longer, in fact. You need to come up with a theory whereby the very same phrase means one thing in 4.3a and a quite different thing in 4.4a.
Under 4.4a, it provides that a participant who attains his deferred vested retirement date.
Right, and the language in 4.3 is a participant who attains his disability retirement date. And you agree in 4.4 that you can attain that date without being a continuous employee.
I did not agree with that.
That's what you told Mr. Reich.
Mr. Reich was told that you have to have your disability cause your termination.
No, in 4.4, you told him that he would be entitled to his deferred vested retirement benefits when he attained the appropriate age.
That's because he is a member. According to 3.2, and this question was asked of counsel for Mr. Reich, there is a provision that would have to be virtually ignored to provide them the interpretation they're seeking.
If you had used the word member in 4.4, I would understand where you're going a little further better, but you don't use the term member in 4.4.
I believe at best we have ambiguity, and under the arbitrary and capricious standard and under the Haichu case that this court has decided, issues of ambiguity are resolved when a deferential standard is available by the plan administrator.
Why do you find it ambiguous when the word isn't used?
I think it is at best ambiguous because to follow the appellant's argument, you would have to ignore the provision of the plan that requires an employee to be disabled. The plan is very clear that you have to be disabled as an employee. It also
and he
would
did become disabled when he was an employee. It's when he came in and said, I'm disabled, I need the oxygen. You said, gee, we don't have any jobs in the plant that can accommodate this particular problem.
There is something,
that moment.
Excuse me, there's something very different between being disabled under the plan's definition and being able to perform a job in a heavy industrial environment.
But that's not an argument you made in your letter to him.
That is correct, because the argument is that if he wasn't disabled as an employee, if he did not get even one of the two things that are required.
But you didn't tell him that that was the reason why he wasn't getting his benefits. You told him it's because he wasn't a participant, because he was a former employee.
And that was correct.
He could have been a former employee because he decided he didn't like working at your plant anymore.
The fact is that Ladish, when it drafted the plan, had to draw the line somewhere in terms of who would be entitled to a disability benefit and who would not. Would it be fair to go 10 years or 20 years and then have some Social Security administrative law judge provide retroactive effect?
But that's impossible under the language of your plan, of course, because you have to, your disability has to be on account of your work at the plant.
Mr. Reich was told in 1995 by his own doctor that he was capable of working. In 1995, Mr. Reich's own doctor said that he was released to return to Ladish, and if he couldn't work there's a strong implication in the record that he could work somewhere else. For 2 years, Mr. Reich was unable to convince the Social Security Administration.
But he did in the end, and you've written that into the plan. He's not going to get benefits for pre-April 1998.
He did not convince anybody that he was disabled, and if you look at...
He did. He convinced the Social Security Administration as of April 1998, and I can assure you, given the cases this court gets, that lots of people fail before that particular body.
And yet that is 3 years after his employment ended, because it would have been dangerous for him to walk around with continuous oxygen in an environment with welding and industrial fumes. But that doesn't satisfy either the Social Security definition of disability or the definition under the plan, which requires him to be incapable of any gainful employment. His doctor, in 1995, when his employment ended, thought he was capable of doing a number of things. He could have been and his doctor didn't say this, but it was implied, he could have been a ticket taker at a movie theater, he could have worked in a library, he could have done a number of things. The question is, when did he satisfy the conditions under the plan of being disabled? And he didn't satisfy them while he was an employee. The definition of disability is that an employee's continuous service be interrupted and broken by a disability, and that disability means that at the time his employment ends, it ends because of a condition that rises to the level under the plan's definition. You require three things. First, finding of Social Security disability. Second, a finding that he was in fact incapable of any gainful employment. And I admit the company didn't advise him of that when they told him about the third thing, which is you have to satisfy the standard while you're an employee. There are over 150 employees, former employees of Ladish, who have, who today receive long-term disability benefits. Mr. Reich simply did not have that level of disability at the time his employment ended.
Thank you, Mr. Stephen. Mr. Allman?
I think the frustration that the court is somewhat expressing is the same frustration that I have had. Is I am waiting to figure out how you can be a participant under one section and how you cannot be a participant in the other section. And that is the question that we've been posing in this case from day one. And I don't think we still have an answer to that question, other than that you have, if you're a participant in one section, you've got to be a participant in the second section. I think really the more interesting question is, what do you do in a situation where the plan administrator has interposed an arbitrary and capricious definition and therefore not reach the question of whether the person was disabled or not? And I think that the analogous case is probably the Ladd versus ITT case, in which you had an in which the plan administrator interposed an arbitrary and capricious definition, and therefore, and the court could not see any distinction between the Social Security definition of disability and the plan definition of disability, and therefore the court ordered summary judgment for the plaintiff. And I think that that is the appropriate remedy in this case, because I think to encourage a plan administrator to interpose this type of arbitrary and capricious definition is not, does not serve the interests of ERISA, and to create this yo-yo effect or this interminable litigation over fairly simple issues really is not the purpose of ERISA. And therefore, I would urge that if you find that the definition or the interpretation is arbitrary and capricious, that you do grant summary judgment to the plaintiff, the appellant.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ullman. Thank you, Mr. Stevens. And the case will be taken under advisement.